From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, End Times Prophecy. And as we start this program, well wishes to Coast guest William Henry's wife, Claire. She's not feeling well at all. Put her on your prayer list. Here's what's happening. Three federal judges voiced deep skepticism about President Trump's temporary ban on immigration from seven majority Muslim nations. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit panel has pounced on the Justice Department lawyer representing the administration for insisting that the travel ban was needed despite existing visa rules and restrictions. Now, the panel, consisting of two judges appointed by Democratic presidents and one by a Republican, expressed some sympathy for the government's fallback position that lawful permanent residents from the seven nations could be excluded from the ban. But the judges questioned whether they or administration officials could rewrite Trump's order on the fly. They expect a decision sometime this week. We shall see. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced to Congress that it will grant the final easement needed to complete the Dakota Access Pipeline. President Trump revived that controversial project by signing an executive order in his first week of office after protests from climate activists and Native American tribes that delayed the line's completion. Wall Street ended higher Tuesday, boosted by corporate earnings, while the dollar climbed to a more than one-week high because of political uncertainty in Europe. Let's check in with Catherine Austin Fitz, investment advisor. Catherine, it looks like everybody's off the economy. They're all concerned about the travel ban and everything else.
Well, if you look at consumer confidence and business confidence, it's very high. So it's interesting, if you talk to the business folks or look at what they're concerned about, they're not paying much attention to the travel ban. That's getting an awful lot of attention and noise.
Yeah.
And clearly the businesses that depend on sort of are culling foreign populations are upset. But I would say generally the business folks are enjoying having business people they can talk to in Washington.
Market seems strong, doesn't it?
The market's strong. The challenge is that what the administration wants to do is the important stuff is getting bogged down in Congress. And one of the reasons is because of the high debt and the concerns about deficits. So, you know, this is all going to come down to whether we're willing to re-engineer the government budget the way we need to. And trying to get Congress to go along with that is going to be tough.
Catherine, some of the people I've interviewed on this program talk about a major collapse in the stock market. Do you see that coming?
Here's the thing, Georgia. I just finished doing the scenarios for our annual wrap-up, and I'm going to send you a hard copy next week.
Okay.
What is important to understand is the variability of what could happen in the future is tremendous, depending on how this next 4 years goes and whether we're successful at sort of re-engineering the federal budget and the economy. If we do a good job, you could see the Dow go up 50% over the next 5 years. If we don't, whew! You know, so the variability, and that's why everybody needs to get in there, and we all need to get about the business of making America great again.
I agree. Let's hope we get away from the whew, and we don't have to go that way. At least three confirmed tornadoes hit southern Louisiana, causing major damage as a wave of severe thunderstorms swept through the region, a few injuries out that way. In Pennsylvania, a woman died, listen to this, after her arm got caught in the door of a clothing drop-off box while apparently removing bags from the container, and she was left dangling with her feet off the ground. Nobody found her until she had passed. Now, we all know what meditation is, but what exactly is mindful meditation? Well, mindful meditation is a form of intentional, focused meditation in which you focus on the current thoughts you're having and sensations that you're experiencing. And according to a new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, this type of meditation is more effective at relieving anxiety and depression than common medications. Dr. Peter Breggin, author of Medication Madness. I like this study, Peter.
Oh, George, it's all good news, and it's this news has been evolving now for a long, long time, that ancient techniques of meditation, sometimes very simplified for modern folks, help with everything from hypertension and indigestion to anxiety and depression. Meditation is in some ways a prayerful state. You know, we seculars don't want to say that. It's a spiritual state in which all the tribulations and trials of life are set aside so that we can focus either through our breathing or our walking or meditating on a sound or on counting our breaths, that we can just get in touch with some sort of a peaceful flow within ourselves. And there are many ways to go about it. I don't know of any adverse effects to it. I think the hardest part about it is for people to get to do it.
But you like the fact that people will get off prescription drugs for this kind of meditation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, many of the people that I help come off psychiatric drugs, which, of course, are terrible neurotoxins. They're the opposite of meditation. They're poisonous to the brain and mind, literally poisonous to the brain and mind. Meditation is enlivening. It usually involves a breathing, and breathing is good for us, and deep breathing is good for us, and paying attention to those kind of processes can be very healthy. I think it just brings us in touch with a sense of self and being that is separate, as I said, from the tribulations, the distractions, the painful stuff we're going through.
I think it's important. Dr. Peter Breggin's website is his last name, BREGGIN.com. Peter, thank you so much. And an amazing story that we discussed last week, and we will for the next couple hours tonight. The Manhattan District's Attorney's Office is looking into the mysterious death 51 years ago of newspaper writer and What's My Line television star Dorothy Kilgallen, who is investigating the JFK assassination.
What's My Line? Now, let's meet our award-winning What's My Line panel. First, the popular columnist whose voice of Broadway appears in the New York Journal American and papers coast to coast, Miss Dorothy Kilgallen.
That was an amazing show at the time. The stunning development comes after a new book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, suggests that Kilgallen was murdered to shut down her relentless pursuit of a mafia don linked to JFK and Lee Harvey Oswald. In a moment, the author of the book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, Mark Shaw, joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, George Norrie with you, former criminal defense attorney, legal analyst for CNN, ESPN, the USA Today, for the Mike Tyson, O.J. Simpson, and Kobe Bryant cases. Mark Shaw is an investigative reporter and author of a number of books, and we're going to talk about one dandy one tonight. He's a member of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, and he's written for the Huffington Post, the Aspen Daily News, USA Today as well. His book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, been so widely read and investigated that, as I mentioned, the Manhattan District's Attorney's Office will look into the death of Dorothy Kilgallen. And let's bring Mark into the program right now. Mark, amazing work, I've got to tell you. I have studied the JFK assassination since it happened when I was 13 years old, and this is one of the best reporting jobs I've ever read.
Well, thank you, George. And first of all, thank you for having me on the program and spreading the word about Dorothy's story. You know, it's fascinating, really, because Dorothy's story has been buried for 50 years. And, you know, you have to think about who she was and how much power she had. Remarkable, remarkable woman. But, you know, unlike any other authors who have written about the JFK assassination, including me, Dorothy was there. And we've proven that she was at the Jack Ruby trial, all the videotapes and everything. And so I think her account of what happened back then is probably the most credible that we've had to date, that's for sure.
She died in 1965, a couple of years after JFK was shot down. And mm-hmm. I remember at that point, I was 15 years old then, Mark, that everybody started talking about she knew something. She was interviewing someone. She interviewed Ruby. She was tying it together with Oswald. And when she died, even at that age, I thought, this is weird, this is strange. But What was the official cause, according to the coroner? What did they say?
Well, it's amazing to think about it, but back then, for whatever reason, you know, Dorothy was writing a book for Random House. And, George, we can trace her steps from when she first began the JFK assassination. You know, she was a very close friend of JFK's, and, in fact, he was so special to her son, Kerry, when they went to the White House, giving him a PT-109 a pin and looking at some letters he brought. I mean, she loved the man, and when he died, she took it personally. And remember, the New York Post called her the most powerful female voice in America. Ernest
right.
Hemingway said she was the greatest female writer in the world. So this was a very powerful woman, and so she went to the Jack Ruby trial, only reporter ever to have interviewed him. And then she exposed his testimony before the Warren Commission, before it was supposed to be released. I mean, it was just amazing what she was able to do. You think about that in terms of the Nixon tapes and Snowden, what he did and all of that. But she was getting herself in danger. She had written all these columns and against the Oswald alone theory. And she had traveled. We don't know exactly what Ruby told her, but she was on her way to New Orleans for the second time. She told one of the hairdressers that if the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it would cost me my life. She told another hairdresser, a good friend of hers, that she was buying a gun and changing her will. And so she was very scared. I think she was very worried about what was going to happen. And on that date you mentioned, November 8, 1965, she was found in her bedroom in her townhouse. And this is what really piqued my curiosity. When I learned that she was found in a bedroom she never slept in a bed she never slept in, wearing her eyelashes, her hairpiece, and her makeup, with clothes on that she never wore to bed. And despite that, there was no investigation. The police came, they decided there was a empty bottle of Secanol on the table. She must have accidentally overdosed and with some alcohol. And so the coroner, the medical examiner came, and they had an autopsy quickly. And he wrote this report, which I was able to find under the Freedom of Information Act from the National Archives, that basically said she died of an overdose of barbiturates and alcohol. But George, at the end of that analysis, he said, circumstances undetermined. And boy, when I read that, I thought, hey, I got to look into this, because anybody with any common sense who would see that kind of a report, and I found other faults with the report later, would say to themselves, we need an investigation, and there was no investigation of any kind. For whatever reason, people just bought the idea that she had some drug problems and alcohol, and the case was basically closed.
She started her career almost before her 18th birthday. Her father was a reporter, and she just loved that lifestyle, and that's what
Correct.
She wanted. Her mother wanted her to be a teacher, I guess.
Yeah.
And so in the reporting, she goes, and she makes a lot of friends. She makes a lot of enemies, Mark, mm-hmm. because she was syndicated in 200 newspapers, which at that time was huge, and that was the major form of news and information in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But she stepped on a lot of toes. I mean, she could make or break careers. Very powerful, as you said.
The power that she had, George. And you have to think about, you know, so many people. I mean, the book has just exploded, and I hear from all these people around the world who have gained a new respect for Dorothy. You know, most people remember her from What's My Line. I did. I didn't know about this other part of her life. But they've found respect for her. They've been captivated by her story and what happened to her. But you have to think about it. You know, we go back to that era. The newspapers were king. There wasn't the internet. Television was in its infancy. And so she was, you know, she was on top of the world in terms of her credibility, the sources that she had. All of that was so important to who Dorothy Kilgallen was. And you know, it's just amazing in so many ways, because she's such an inspiration. College dropout, and she got into the newsroom through her father, and then she just, you know, you talk about somebody breaking the glass ceiling. Well, they didn't even know what it meant then, but Dorothy was this incredible investigative reporter, the journalist, had the radio program.
Which, by the way,
three children. I mean, she was an amazing woman.
Her radio show is on my affiliate in New York, WOR.
That,
you talk about being ironic here. So as she evolves, as she gets into the status that she became, she gets married to a guy, right? And has kids, but she also, you know, I guess he goes astray, and then so she does too. What happens there?
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to be on your show is that you're so well respected, George, for really seeking the truth. And that's who Dorothy Kilgallen was. You know, she was a woman who was looking for the truth, and that got her in trouble with the JFK assassination, and it got her in trouble with a lot of people. Like you said, she had enemies on one side and friends on the other. I mean, Sinatra hated her, for instance, and J. Edgar Hoover was certainly an enemy, as was this Carlos Marcello in New Orleans.
Oh yeah.
But you know, she made a lot of enemies, but she also commanded the respect of an awful lot of people. And I've had so many women, especially, write to me with emails and say, "We need more reporters like Dorothy Kilgallen because she did one thing that was really important, and we don't have enough of that today." And that is, she sought the truth, she found the facts, and then she did exactly what you said you do on your show. She presented the facts for people, and then they could make up their own mind.
That's
she didn't
right.
try to tell them everything. She did what you said that you do. She got the facts together, she got as much of the truth together, and then she let people make up their mind.
And in your book, people will be able to make up their own mind, and it's an amazing summary in terms of what they're going to, I think, come up with as they look about this. She would have been a key player in unraveling the JFK assassination. There's no doubt about it in my mind.
Oh, yes, and that's unfortunate, because what I say to people is the killer's won here. You know, there's no question that Kilgallen did not commit suicide. That's absurd, as pointed out in the book. This whole thing with accidental death makes no sense. There was a corrupt medical examiner. The autopsy report was flawed. There was even a cover-up after the cover-up that happened. I mean, it was all just a complete mess in terms of getting any idea of what actually happened there. But the killers won here, George, because she had a thick investigation file. She had all the best sources. She had told everybody she was going to crack this case. She was going to write the book for Random House. I mean, she was ready to go with all of this information, and it got buried.
Yeah, well, it sure did.
For whatever reason, believed the worst about her, and they didn't say, "Wait a minute, that doesn't sound like Dorothy Kilgallen, the one that I know." And so all that material has been buried. And there's so many books out there about the JFK assassination, but I've said recently in many of my presentations, there is no discussion of the JFK assassination anymore that doesn't include what Dorothy Kilgallen uncovered about the assassinations. It's a critical part of the equation and should be taken into consideration all of the time.
We're with Mark Shaw. He wrote the book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, about Dorothy Kilgallen. What is the Manhattan District Attorney's Office doing about this now?
Well, this is a good story, and I'll tell you, you know, if you're a person of the truth, and I am, there's a suspect still alive that I think had something to do with Kilgallen's death. His name is Ron Pataki. He was a journalist in Columbus, Ohio. He still is. He's 81 years old.
We tried calling him tonight, by the way, and he never answered his phone.
I'm sure he probably didn't, George. I told him, you know, that I was honing in on him. I think he's the last person to be to see Kilgallen the night before she died. I interviewed him three times. I told him I was going to put all this in the book. I sent him a book to let him know what was going on. And, you know, there's some real incriminating evidence in there. And I think this is what the DA picked up on, two things, really. But the first one is Ron Pataki and his involvement in this. People are going to be shocked. And I've heard so many people. There are two poems that he wrote. And it's my belief, and I think it's proven in the book, that the way Kilgallen really died is that she was poisoned, that her drink was either poisoned with barbiturates at the Regency Hotel the night before she died or at her townhouse hours before
mm-hmm.
she died.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Pataki, one of his poems is called Vodka Roulette, Seen as Relief Possibility.
Jeez.
And it's got a little picture of a bartender, and then I'll just read you the
hold on
line.
For that. We're going to hit the break, Mark. Let's come back to that in just a moment. Mark Shaw, our special guest, the reporter. And welcome back to Coast, Mark Shaw with us. The name of the book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, and he is naming names here tonight, folks. So let's go into this poem, Mark, that you said you have, and how did you get it?
Yeah, well, let's set the stage, because the question you asked was, why did the, you know, people have asked me, how in the world did you get the New York Medical Examiner's office to open an investigation here on Dorothy Kilgallen's death 52 years ago? And, you know, I'm surprised. I thought they would say, well, you know, Mark, we had 25 murders in the Bronx last night. We don't have time to look at a murder 52 years old. But the whole book is about justice, and I'm fighting for Dorothy's justice, her having justice, because it was denied to her 65 years ago. People may wonder also, why does it make any difference? Well, I think in the book we prove that she was killed. It was the worst form of censorship you can have for writing a book. And murder is murder, whether it's 5 days ago or 5 years ago or 50 years ago. And it doesn't matter if it's Dorothy Kilgallen or Dorothy Doe, she has rights as a victim. And I don't believe she got those rights 50 years ago. So I decided to write the DA. I sent him a letter with all of my evidence in it. I sent him another letter with all the contact information, and I didn't know if I'd hear back from them about this.
And they've read the book, right?
And they've and then Sue Adelman, who is a champion reporter for the New York Post, wrote one article, two-page article about the book and Dorothy's case in December. And then last Sunday, a week ago Sunday, she reported that the DA was looking into the investigation. A staffer had read the book. They were looking for documents they might find at the medical examiner's office. And then communication came to me yesterday that a detective or an assistant DA will be in touch with me. And one of the reasons is because there's a suspect still alive. And you have to understand that Ron Pataki was one of Dorothy Kilgallen's lovers. She and her husband...
Let's point this out, Mark, that you're saying a possible suspect, and that's important.
Well, I think he's a strong suspect.
Right, nonetheless.
As I said, you know, when you want to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, but if you read in the book his statements he made, they're very conflicting. But what really, I think, made a difference with the DA is this one poem, and it's entitled Vodka Roulette, Seen as Relief Possibility. Now, I think we've proven in the book that there were three barbiturates in her stomach, not just one. There was a medical examiner cover-up. The medical examiner's office, we have eyewitnesses who were there at the time. All of these videos with these people are up on DorothyKilgallenStory.org. People can watch them. And they'll see that there's no question that this woman was killed. Well, how was she killed? Well, the way she was killed, I believe, was that her drink was poisoned. So just listen to the lines in this poem. There's a little image of a bartender, and then Ron wrote, "While I'm spilling my guts, she is driving me nuts. Please fetch us two drinks on the run. Just skip all the noise and make one of them poison, and don't even tell me which one." Now, you know, he told me that those are humorous poems that he wrote. One of them is about muzzling a writer at a typewriter.
I don't see anything funny about that.
No, not at all. And I think that's what sticks out. You know, I feel a real validation with the facts that I have presented in the book by the DA looking into this. I don't think they would have if they thought there was nothing there. And so my hope is that... they'll look into Ron, they'll investigate him, they'll interview him, and we also hope, and it's happened since Sue's article a week ago Sunday, I'm learning from people across the country new information about what happened to Dorothy. And the DA has said to me, Mark, people should call the office if they have new information about that or let you know and all of that. So I'm hoping this is going to be a thorough investigation, but I really applaud Sivers Vance Jr. and the New York District Attorney Office for looking into this.
Wasn't there someone who was with her a couple hours before she reportedly died at a bar or something like that?
Yeah, you're right, and very good question. The situation is this. We know that Dorothy, on the 7th of November, had her last What's My Line television show. And on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, you will see one of her closest friends, a hairdresser, talk about him getting her ready for that show. She appeared on that show that evening. She was sharp. She guessed the occupation of a woman who lived in Tennessee or Kentucky, I believe, who sold dynamite. And after that show, then we know that she went to P.J. Clark's, which was a bar. It's a bar in New York City. It's still there with a producer on the show, had a couple drinks, and then went to the Regency Hotel 6 blocks from where her townhouse was. On this website, the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, you'll see Catherine Stone, who was the woman that was on the show who sold the dynamite. She went to an after-hours party at the Regency, and she saw Kilgallen in a booth with a man. She couldn't identify the man. They were sitting very close together, and they were talking very seriously. And the reason that we believe that's Ron Pataki is just before that, Kilgallen had told this hairdresser that she believed Ron Pataki may be leaking information about her JFK assassination. He was a journalist as well.
From Columbus,
so
right?
All that fits together with what Catherine Stone says and points to Ron Pataki as well.
Now let's talk about, for a moment, Mark, what we think Dorothy Kilgallen knew about the JFK assassination.
Yeah.
Because she was miles ahead of the Warren Commission. And in subsequent investigations that we have done, we have concluded that the mob was heavily involved in JFK's murder, that they really wanted Bobby Kennedy to stop doing what he was doing to them. And the name you mentioned, Carlos Marcello, was involved and knew Jack Ruby. Ruby worked for him. And, you know, Ruby was the front man for, I think, Marcello's strip clubs.
You and Dorothy would get along just right because you're right in line with what she thought happened. You know, I was never going to write this book, George. I had no, compunction to do this. But I wrote a book about Melvin Belli, the great famous lawyer from San Francisco,
right,
who was Jack Ruby's lawyer. And while I was investigating that book, a friend of his said that after Dorothy died, Belli said, well, they've killed Dorothy, now they'll go after Ruby. And that piqued my curiosity,
wow.
And I knew about Belli's affection for the mafia because I used to practice law in his building, and so I started working backwards, just as you have, going back to the Kennedys' double cross of the mafia during the 60 election and all the way through to the one man who hated the Kennedys any more than anybody else, and that was Carlos Marcello. So then we couple that with after the one place that Kilgallen goes after she talks to Jack Ruby at the trial is where? She doesn't go to Washington, D.C. She goes to New Orleans,
mm-hmm,
where Marcello was. And the weird thing about that is the hairdresser went with her. And while they were in New Orleans, she called him at the hotel and said, go back to New York City. Don't tell anybody you were here and don't ask any more questions. And I think that points to the fact that whatever Kilgallen found in New Orleans, and we believe from her columns about questioning the Oswald alone theory written 6 days after Kennedy was killed, all of that, that she had connected Marcello with Ruby and with Oswald, and that she knew that Carlos Marcello was the man who had masterminded the JFK and Oswald assassinations. So now she's got this thick investigative file, George, and she's going to write a book for Random House. Well, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out they could not let her write that book. They could not let her go back to New Orleans because she was going to expose those people that she knew were involved with the assassinations.
Do we know if that file was ever found? Her notes? Everything she was working on?
No, it hasn't, and one of my hopes
Well.
It disappeared. Her husband, Richard, and as I said, they went opposite directions. He gave a couple conflicting reports. One damaging one really was that he said the file has caused enough trouble and that he got rid of it. But there's a lot of conjecture. You know, the book is set up as a true crime murder mystery because there's so many suspects here. You said Dorothy made friends and enemies. Well, she made a lot of enemies. And so there's several suspects in the book, but, my feeling is that there might be somebody out there who knows where that file is. And my feeling is that old Ron Pataki may know where that file is, or at least he knows what happened back then.
Or
and
where
I'm hoping
it went.
That at some point he will come forward with the truth.
I keep knocking my head against the wall, Mark, trying to figure out why did the government whitewash the investigation with this Warren Commission report, which was loaded with the errors. And the only thing I've been able to come up with so far is because people like Carlos Marcello, Santos Traficante, and all these other people involved were also involved in trying to kill Castro for the government. And my conclusion is that they decided they could not come forward and tell everybody what really happened to Kennedy because all these other players who were still alive then at that time after the assassination would have destroyed this thing about the government trying to kill Fidel Castro a zillion times. That's my conclusion on that. How close am I?
You may be right. I think, though, that, again, I'm a former criminal defense lawyer, so I look at motive. And, you know, there's no question that that Marcello was the one that Bobby Kennedy went after Joe Kennedy told him that if they helped him win the election, you know, they leave those guys alone. I'll tell you who I've come to admire, and it's in a sinister way, and that's J. Edgar Hoover. You know, if you think about the situation where JFK is killed, well, Hoover has a choice to make. He can either say, you know, listen, hey, there may have been a conspiracy here and the government, we're going to go after everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Or he can say, hey, it was one nut, it was one crazy guy named Oswald, and that was it. Well, we know he chose that one.
Yeah.
And he shouted the Oswald alone theory to everyone, that there was nobody else involved. He wrote those memos that you probably know about to the Justice Department saying there's no evidence of anyone else. And he kept shouting that and shouting that, and then he shouted it through the Warren Commission, which he controlled. And so everybody went the wrong direction here.
Thanks to him. Why would he do it?
Oswald, and Dorothy knew Oswald wasn't the key to this. She knew the key was Jack Ruby.
Yeah.
And when she went to that trial, that's who she honed in on. You know, these videotapes, I hate to keep mentioning them, but on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, there are four clips from a videotape interview with Joe Tannehill, who was Jack Ruby's co-counsel. And he will tell you, you can watch him say how Ruby respected her, how the interviews came about, where they took place, and his feelings about what Ruby may have told her. That's eyewitness testimony. That's the credibility for the book. And she knew that Ruby was the key, and that's where everybody went the wrong way. I mean, George, 7 days JFK was killed, the first column, which people can read on the site as well, was called Oswald File Must Not Close. And then she wrote a string of those saying it makes no sense with regard to going that way. But by then, the American public and everybody else was looking in the wrong direction.
Yep.
And that's why we have the distortions of history through the years.
They did, at the time, publicly, a great job pushing people and distorting people into the lone gunman theory while this conspiracy was going on. And, you know, like you say, and as you write in the book, the reporter who knew too much, she, you know, was one of those ready to break this. Wasn't she working with Mark Lane at the time, too, who's been on the program and one of the huge JFK conspiracy investigators?
I'll tell you, that's one of the sad things here. I tried to interview Mr. Lane, and I have such respect for him. As you know, he was in ill health prior to his finally passing away last year.
Yeah.
And I wrote to him and heard a little something, and then I could never interview him before he died because he was the only person that she trusted. I don't care what anybody else says. He's the only person she trusted. They met. They talked about her investigation. They used some false names because they both thought they were in danger. But, yes, he's the guy that she trusted, and he's the one, I believe, who would have been the best witness to have told us more about what Dorothy uncovered, but unfortunately, I wasn't able to get to him before this truth-telling man, I believe, passed away.
What do you think the outcome, Mark, might be of this Manhattan District Attorney's investigation, and will they follow through with this?
Well, there's two or three things that I hope can happen. I said there were two reasons why I think they opened this up, George. One is because of the suspect still being alive. We've proven there's a homicide, the victim has rights, and all of that. The other is this incredible corruption that was in the New York Medical Examiner's office at the time. There's a lot of spiritual aspect of the Dorothy Kilgallen story that we could talk about a little bit because, frankly, and people may think I'm a crazy man, but I think Dorothy chose me to tell this story. For whatever reason, a lot of things have happened where I felt like she's guided me with my investigation throughout all this. And she guided me along to new evidence that I didn't know about. A few times when I was going to give up, I kind of felt her tapping my shoulder and saying, go this way or that way.
Helping you with the lead, huh?
Yeah, and a couple times when I was going to quit, you know, all of that. And even today, you know, it's interesting because the reporter that I mentioned, Sue Edelman, with the Post, had written a series of articles in the last few years, about corruption in the New York Medical Examiner's office. And so this was right up her alley when she learned that I had eyewitnesses, three toxicologists that were in the medical examiner's office during the years that Kilgallen died. They talked about, especially one of them, people will read about it, that the, you know, Dorothy died in Manhattan, George, but they did not call the Manhattan Medical Examiner's office. They called the Brooklyn office, another
That's strange.
Obvious, you know, distortion there in terms of what should have happened. And this this toxicologist, Stephen Goldner, Dr. Stephen Goldner, will say, Brooklyn office was mafia controlled. He has a great quote in the book. It wasn't like Joe Bonanno walked in the door every day, but we knew what was going on. They falsified autopsy reports. They finally fired Dr. Goldman and this John Broach, who was another toxicologist, because they wouldn't sign phony autopsies. And so there's all that corruption in the medical examiner's office, and I think that's another thing that has gotten the eye of the New York District Attorney, and I hope they're going to look seriously into what happened there. We hope there's some documents that they may uncover that will provide some clarity here with regard to the truth about what happened.
Well, let's hope that the DA, Cyrus Vance Jr., doesn't think that he's going to go the way of the Jim Garrison.
Mm-hmm.
And back off because
you know it's interesting. People have different thoughts about Jim Garrison. It's interesting in the JFK film, of course. You know they were trying to figure out what to do, and there's that scene in his office where he's talking to his assistants, and somebody mentions Carlos Marcello, and he says, "Oh no, let's not go that way. Let's go after Clay Shaw." So he missed this, but you know what? He never talked to Dorothy Kilgallen.
Right.
He never looked at all those columns and articles. The Warren Commission didn't look
at
those. A lot of people, the authors through the years, Ron, Gerald Posner and Vincent Bugliosi, who I know and knew before he died, and all these other authors, they missed it.
Hold on, Mark. We're coming back for more, and we're going to open up the phone lines, too, and let our listeners chat with you. We'll be back.